I remember the madness of the mind when I'd say to myself, well, I've not done it in weeks. And suddenly I get a flashback, bang, it was yesterday. It was 2 hours ago. My mind was playing tricks on me. I thought I was going mental. I thought I was losing my mind. It was the scariest thing to feel like you're losing your mind. Mm. You're losing who you are. You don't know who you are anymore. Your brain's completely wired to it, you know, and it's just nothing but pain, but you just keep going back to it.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholefield. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction, and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery, or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Our guest today is Jamie Skipper, an ex-doorman who left his colourful life in the past. Jamie now helps kids embrace resilience in schools by utilising his master NLP training and his physical skills as a personal trainer. He speaks honestly and openly about his past experiences training hard as a bodybuilder and using a cocktail of drugs at the same time, which ended in a bad way with Jamie losing trust in himself and living with shame and guilt that he has now left behind. Jamie, welcome to This Is Powerful. Thanks for coming in, mate. I know you're a busy person.
Yeah, very busy.
So being a mindset coach, working with young kids, you work with knife crime.
Yeah.
You're a brilliant NLP coach.
Yeah.
And your goal is to help younger people, as well as a PT.
Yes.
A good one, because I've been trained by you.
Jack of all trades.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'd love to go back to where you're from and how your upbringing was.
Yeah. You got enough time?
With plenty.
Yeah, brilliant. So started out, I was born in East Ham, sort of like we moved from East Ham to Romford. So about, you know, 2 or 3 years old. So most of my life lived in Romford, then Hornchurch, around the Hornchurch area, which is, you know, it's a bit like yourself. It was good growing up. There's three of us, I'm the eldest of three. Good childhood, you know, 80s, typical 80s childhood, you know, taking risks, building ramps, playing in the road when loads of traffic was coming by, you know,
yeah.
Kicking a football in the road. Good memories, really good memories. I say good memories, you know, like I tend to look back with a sense of nostalgia. But obviously there were hard times. You know, mum, dad was a plumber, working hard. You know, mum ended up being a nurse. So My family were grafters, you know. It was I had good work ethics, good background, you know.
Yeah.
I tended to look back at my childhood like it was an amazing childhood, and it was, you know, but there were some bits where I had to face some bits that I didn't like about my childhood. You know, I had a really bad eczema, you know, and there were times when I was very much on my own. I struggled with my confidence. I was a really shy kid. There were.
Is that because of the eczema? Because that's quite a painful thing to have, actually.
Yeah, I had to go to Harley Street to a specialist. I had really bad eczema. Every time I open my hands up, they bleed. Kids, you know what kids are like, you know, they said leprosy and, you know, I laugh about it now, but at the time it was quite hurtful, you know, no one to hold your hand crossing the road, you know, we had to go to the dinner, demountable dinner ladies, you know, dinner rooms. So it was, there were some, as I went through my journey, I sort of had to look back on some bits where actually there were some bits that weren't always, you know, beers and Skittles. They weren't always plain sailing. There were some bits where it was hard and I did struggle with confidence. I was quite shy. And yeah, the eczema, and still now and again, you'll still see me do this thing sometimes, cover my hands. You know, but I kind of like, I grew up with that sense of humour, though, that kind of banter that I suppose now would be frowned upon. Yeah. But that banter, but I found having that sense of humour gets you through. Got me through. My dad was, you know, a good wind-up, you know, he used to wind me up because he used to say, oh, you're too sensitive. And I suppose in his eyes, he was getting me ready for the real world, you know.
Yeah.
As we know, working on building sites, it hits you hard, you know. And if you can't take the wind up, you end up like getting yourself in all sorts of trouble, you know. So, yeah.
How was school then? I know you got tormented for that, but how was your school and your secondary school and your education?
I found it was quite hard fitting in, first of all. Primary school was, junior school was, I don't really know what I learned. You know, there was a pattern forming from primary school. I used to avoid certain work, avoid things, and any homework or any work. There's a classic example. My dad still laughs about this now. He said, do you remember when you chucked all your homework or your unfinished work over the back of the back of the garden, you know? And that was like not finishing work, not completing things, finding it hard, then hiding work. So there was a pattern forming from primary school. I just wasn't getting it, and I wasn't finishing things either. And I couldn't concentrate on one thing. And then when I went into, you know, went into senior school, the first year was hell because it hits you hard. You're like, you know, suddenly you're a little fish in a big pond.
Yeah.
And it's just the stress of, they used to call me the ultimate warrior because I used to stress all the time about forget my homework, you know, lose my homework diary. Then, you know, and I had the intelligence. I knew I was intelligent, but I just felt like I was failing, you know, and I looked at other friends and it looked like it was easy for them. You know, they just remembered things that I didn't, you know, and then they go, have you done your homework, Skipper? And I'd be like, and it set into panic, you know. And I kind of like, it, at school, I kind of like, if you like, I kind of formed a character. So I figured out that if I was funny, I could make people laugh, you know. So
it's a good defense system.
Yeah. And still now, you know, I've been all through my years of therapy and I still catch myself making jokes, you know, and I'll make a little joke and it's not really for the person, it's for me, to make me feel relaxed, you know, and sometimes not always appropriate, but, you know, it relaxes me and it's a way of, you know, I'll take the piss out of yourself, don't take yourself too seriously.
Yeah.
And it's so funny, like, I hear my dad's voice when I'm talking to my own kids, you know.
Yeah.
You know, my partner would say to me, why are you saying that? So I'm getting ready for the real world. It's a tape recorder. you're a little bit of a banter, a bit of wind up, you're getting ready for the real world, and it's your upbringing.
Do you feel that the things you've been through as a child, and because you're so sensitive, I mean, for people who are listening, Jamie's like 6'3", and he's wider than I am tall, and I've seen him in a gym. He's a scary man, and he used to be a doorman. So, you know, to talk about stuff so sensitive when you was younger, it's a powerful, a powerful thing.
Yeah.
So do you think that that's helped you as a good coach?
Yeah, I think they say in psychology, perception is projection, right? So you're kind of like, I feel like, you know, it's almost like that inner child. When you're at schools, you understand it. You understand the kids that are not getting on.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of feel it, you know. And I'll talk to people. I've got no problem talking. You know, I'll chat to anyone. You know, we're in a restaurant and my missus will be like, oh, here he goes. You know, chatting away and asking them where they're from and, you know, hear an accent. I'm just interested in people. And I've always been that way. And I feel like that was my natural ability as a kid, because if you're not academic, you find other ways.
Yeah.
And I found that I was funny. And then, you know, I played the character of being funny for a while and I was the joker. Then, you know, you're getting in trouble at school. And then I got, you know, I experienced a little bit of bullying and I wasn't happy with the way I felt. I felt quite sad in myself. I was like, you know what, I need to work on myself. And at the time, we talk about Arnold Schwarzenegger, we talk about the bodybuilding world. And I really got into bodybuilding. You know, I started going to the gym at 14, you know.
Did you really?
Yeah, 14 years old, started going to the gym. Started lifting weights, bought the Arnold Schwarzenegger book, Encyclopedia of Bodybuilding, started studying it. You know, I wanted to get big, hench, as they say these days. And it was all about, for me, it was about, I started to build another character. You know, I was the joker. And then found out, you know, I got picked on a little bit and I felt like I had to sort of step it up a little bit. So now I started to create this other character, you know, and I started to get into boxing. You know, and I loved boxing. I boxed at a local club and I loved the buzz. Yeah. And my anger suddenly was channeled. So I wasn't losing my temper as much. I was channeling it.
Mm.
But then I was doing the weights, doing the boxing. I was, you know, doing arm wrestling competitions and I was getting significance, getting my needs met. You know, I was getting significance. I was getting that kind of like, oh yeah, Jamie. And I loved it. You know what I mean? And it's because I was still that shy little boy that didn't have the confidence. You know what I mean?
Did you notice a mask? Was it just to build yourself up because then people wouldn't bully you?
As a kid, I kind of wasn't aware of it. I was just, you know, giving it the large all the time. I was, you know, giving it big Johnny peanuts, you know, like really. And I kind of like, I had a really good group of friends, still friends now, you know, and I kind of like had that significance amongst them. You know, my friends are not fighters, you know, and true, deep down, I'm not a fighter, you know, but because of the experience I had, a little bit of bullying and, you know, I don't want to get into a sob story, but there were some times where I felt like there's nothing worse than feeling like you can't fight back, you know, and I really relate to these kids. It's one of my triggers, you know, so I have to make sure I do the work. Because, you know, like perception is projection. If you can easily get triggered when someone's getting bullied, you've got to be really careful. You've got to make sure you're regulating your emotions and your feelings, especially in a conversation, you know, because it can bring back your stuff, you know, that inner child stuff, you know. So I felt like the boxing was, it was a release. It was a control. It was a discipline. And my hero was Muhammad Ali. You know, I read his book. I watched his life story about, you know, someone stole his bike. And he was bullied, and I kind of like really, really related to the story.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a turning point for me, because my dad says, 14 years old, he said, "You just changed." I don't know what it was. You was this shy kid. You was a bit of a joker, having a laugh, and then suddenly he said, "You went. I'm going to go boxing." I got the Yellow Pages out. There was no internet, was there? So I got the Yellow Pages out. Found the local club in Hornchurch, and I've got a bus, which was unusual for me.
It's quite a brave move.
Yeah. And it was a turning point. I just had enough. I'd had enough, and I wanted to really start to define myself. But consequently, what happens is you start creating a character. And I got bigger. I trained. I got more sort of like more attention. And if you think of it, the muscles is like a suit of armor. You know, you don't want anyone to know really on the inside. You're sensitive, you know. Yeah. And you're giving it the large, you're giving it the big, and you're coming across quite arrogant. And people say you're quite vain because you, and then you're getting into the bodybuilding, you're looking in the mirror, looking at your progress. You didn't have phones back then, but you looked in the mirror like a weirdo. And I was easily influenced at that age. You're modeling people, you're looking around you, you know, and I still had that kind of insecurity. And I remember there was a guy in there, he was about 6'6", 6'5", you know, he was a doorman. And I was like, oh, I'd start training with him. You know, I started training Brian's gym in Barking, proper hardcore gym, you know, spit and sawdust, you know, like, everyone was on the voids. You walk in and the first thing I do is ask you if you want to do a course of steroids. I was like, no. I'm like, I'm a kid. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I trained with this doorman and he was menacing. He was a tower, you know. He took me under his wing. There was a little group of us. We used to do martial arts on a Saturday. Started kickboxing, started doing the martial arts, got good at it, got stronger. And then, you know, come 20 years old, you know, he's like, why don't you come work for me? Come and work in the door, you know. And I was like, yes, you know, I was so excited. I was like, I'm going to be a doorman.
I guess you feel recognised as when then, yeah. You're in a power of position.
Yeah, and I saw the attention that all the doormen at the gym were getting.
Yeah.
You know, I loved that kind of like, I was so impressed by it, that respect that they got, you know. And I worked on it. I started at my first pub in Dagenham. And
posh place.
Very posh. In between all this, I was clubbing, I was going out a lot. But I was teetotal. I was into my training so much, you know, and every now and again, I'd lose my way, would go to a club or whatever, lose my way a little bit. There was things in the background starting, growing, but then I had this other character that was teetotal and didn't drink. And my mates used to say, "Skipper, calm down." We used to go out and I used to see things happening and pull them out of the way and a bottle would fly off or, you know, I couldn't calm.
It's like he was on a mission, wasn't it?
Yeah, I felt like some sort of like agent when I went out. You could see things happening when you went out, and I could never really relax. You know, I couldn't chill out. I was working on the door one night. We'd thrown a guy out. He was quite out of it, quite aggressive. He threatened to come back, and he said, "Oh, I'm going to come back, and I'm going to shoot you." And I had this feeling. I just had this gut feeling. I thought, he's going to come back. And all the doormen are going, "Shut up, he's not coming back." And I went, "I'm telling you, he's going to come back." I don't know what it was. We're all standing there. I'm standing at the front, my normal position. And he leant out the car and he pulled out a pistol, you know. And like I moved so fast, you know, and I was like, "He's got a gun." I moved out of the way.
Yeah.
bolted all the doors up. All my friends thought it was a joke because I was always joking around. They thought it was actually a wind-up, you know. And then he ended up just driving off, you know. And
fortunately,
it done me nothing. It really twisted. It done my head in a little bit, you know. I was 20 years old. Yeah. You know, I was still at home. I was living in the extension at home. I come home and my dad was like, "How was it tonight?" I went, "Yeah, it's all right." I said, "Oh, I'd be shook up, really. Someone pulled a gun, you know." And it turned out to be a replica. It wasn't a real gun. But it was, I think for me, the alarm bell started ringing. And my dad said, 20 years old. He said, mate, you're working like, was it 40, 50 quid a night, whatever it was. And he said, is your life worth that much, you know? And my dad always had the wisest words, you know. He didn't say much, but it always got to me when he said it. He said, is it really worth it? And I was like, you know, and I kind of like, I wasn't happy with the jobs I was doing during the daytime. I hadn't done too well at school. That was a bit painful. I was working, I think, security in Tesco. I was doing these bits and bobs. I couldn't hold a job down because I was working on the door at night time. I was somebody. And then during the daytime, someone talks to you like, oh, yeah, do this, do that. And who are you talking to? I'm like, I've got that kind of dormant ego.
Regulate the thing.
Yeah. I'm like, who are you talking to? Like, I'm used to this kind of respect when I'm on in the evenings. I just couldn't hold a job down.
And back then, though, it's interesting because I don't know doorman now, but back then it was an era where doorman were someone you were respected, and people would talk about, oh, I know Jamie on the door, he can get us in, or he's really cool and stuff. You actually was a position then.
It was the golden days. You know, it's before the badge come out, so you had doorman that had, you know, a shady past. But the thing was, they knew who was who, you know. They knew it was kind of like you felt safe.
Well, those generally proper tough guys
you know, not, you know, they were like, and some of them quite fearless to the point of, you know, my dad used to say to me, son, you're not brought up like that. Like you're not wired like that. Do you know what I mean? And to a point he was right. You know, I was Queensbury Rules and I was working with people who were just on another level. They had no fear, you know, like I was trying to thinking about, actually, I don't want to die, but some of these were like fearless, you know what I mean? And just going in without any regard to what would happen and the outcome. And I started to realise that actually, I don't think I'm cut out for this. Do you know what I mean? And then when that happened to me, like, I was like, it just done me nothing. I was like, so I decided in my wisdom to take off and travel. So I kind of thought, right, I've had enough of my life. I've had enough of this, and I couldn't relax because I couldn't switch off my doorman head, and I wasn't enjoying it, you know. So 20 years old, I shot off and I went to Israel. I lived in Israel on a kibbutz for about 7 or 8 months.
Grew your hair long.
Yeah, I was a bit of a hippie, you know.
Was this part of searching? Was that searching for a deeper Jamie because you knew you weren't really the doorman?
Yeah, it was kind of like it was the end of a... I thought it was the end of a character, a death of one ego, and the start of something else, you know, because I come back and I'm now, I'm like an annoying hippie talking about world peace, you know. And, you know, my dad's like, oh, here we go. So, we're talking about world peace, you know, talking about traveling and see the world, you know. And
you've seen it, you know. Deeply enlightened.
Yeah. So now I've come back, you know, and I've kind of like ended that character, if you like. And I thought, I'm never doing the door again. I'm never, ever doing it again. I got back and I was teetotal. I used to train and take it really seriously. And in Israel, I started to have like a drink, you know, like they would just do damn vodka, we're doing the kibbutz nights, and they have a chill out, have a drink. You know, and we're drinking this Russian vodka, and, you know, there was rumors of people going blind on it, you know.
that stuff's strong.
Yeah. And we were, and I started to enjoy myself. I started to loosen up a little bit, you know. And I thought, oh, maybe I need to chill out. This is like, you know, and I kind of like I was over the gun thing. That was done. I was over it. Came back. Swore I was never going to work on the door again. And then I kind of like, I was in the gyms again, back into my bodybuilding, bumped into a guy, he's like, hello, do you want to come work for me? And then I'm at Faces nightclub, now I'm working on the door again. Yeah, but this time I've got a dicky bow and I've got a black suit. So it's kicked it all off again. Now I look like a proper bouncer. I've got like a bow tie, a black suit, do you know what I mean? And I'm like, I'm at Faces nightclub, there's all the footballers coming in. Not that it helped me because I don't know who the footballers are. You know, one night I didn't let in Frank Lampard. I didn't know who he was. So, you know, not the best doorman, but, you know, and it was the era of, you know, the footballers and all like the kind of the villains and stuff all mixing up.
What year was this?
This was about 97, 90, probably about 2000, 2001, something like that. Yeah, 2002.
Yeah, so the end of the rave period. And Faces, for those who don't know, is in a place called Gants Hill in East London, which was a really amazing club, right?
Yeah, it was, yeah, it was banging. It was, and I used to enjoy it. It was buzzy, you know, and it was kind of like I was into my training again. I got back into my martial arts, got back into my weights, you know, the suit of armour was going on again.
And did you stop drinking then when you come back from the
Yeah, so I was kind of like, I was back on the straight and narrow, you know. Yeah. And I, all throughout, you know, all my time, it was intermittent, as in like I would be, you know, I would make back in the rave days, you know, early days, you know, I've got to add that, you know, we'd be doing, everyone would be doing, you know, pills or whatever, you know, and that, that was, and I was like, oh, I'm never doing that, you know, and then I just tried it one night, and at the time there was the Leah Betts thing, and everyone was terrified of doing them, you know.
Yeah.
And I think I had a really bad experience on it. I felt sick and I thought I was going to die, you know, and I was, I'm never going to do that again. And then I ended up doing it again, you know, and it's kind of like, it was intermittent, and I'd be like, no, I don't need that. I'd get into my training. You know, I kept swinging from one extreme to another, you know, that kind of cross addiction, if you like, that when I'm training, I'm like this person. And when I'm that person, it's like I'm loosening up. I'm two kind of very different sides to myself, you know.
Yeah.
So that was the start for me. And then I kind of got caught up in this kind of this dormer. And then I started working, I qualified as a personal trainer. And I loved it. I was like, wow. Like,
did you do that because you knew that the doorman job would sort of slide away? Or was that sort of protection to have extra work on that?
I mean, I didn't have any career. I had no idea what I was going to do. I really was lost. And it was on the kibbutz, actually. I was training every day and I had a little following. People come around with do press-ups and boxing and all that. They said, why don't you be a personal trainer? I was like, what, you know, 30 jobs later, I could have been a personal trainer. And this was, again, the heyday of PT, personal trainer, Holmes Place, the luxury gyms.
Mm.
And I got qualified and I didn't pass anything. Most of my things in life, I had to resit my exams and stuff. And I passed it with flying colours. I remembered everything. Mm. You know, my biology was bang on. I passed like, you know, real high grades and I passed with flying colours. And suddenly I'm like, I'm good at this. I'm really good at this. I'm a motivator. You know, I looked the part at the time, you know, I thought I did. And I had a bit of a following.
Well, no, you did and you were. I have been trained by you. I think personally, one of the best trainers I've experienced because you do have that knowledge, but you've trained yourself.
Yeah.
So you have the inner knowledge as well, as in you've trained since you're 14.
Yeah.
And boxed and done all the martial arts. And I think when someone does all of those, you physically know yourself really well.
Yeah. Yeah. You kind of like have this intuition with your own body.
Yeah.
And you know when you've gone in too hard sometimes, you know. And I kind of like, I've done yoga, you know, do yoga as well, breath work. I'm holistic. I qualified as a Reiki master. I went down that road as well. And I've done so much stuff. I mean, I only got enough time to tell you like the madness and the rabbit holes I've gone down. I got into Taoism, Buddhism, you know, but this was more later on, you know, because I kind of like, there was a change. The door was, it was kind of like, it was working. I still had that image. I was PTing in the city in the daytime. You know, I loved the kind of city life, you know, working up London, just local actually, like Broadgate Circle and Holmes Place in London.
Mm.
And it was great, you know. But there was an exposure. I was starting to see things. I went out with someone who was doing drugs, using quite a lot. And I was like, I used to look at, what are you doing? That's disgusting, you know? And I never thought I could be one of those people. Do you know what I mean?
What age was this?
This is about 20, sort of 25, 26, you know.
Which a lot of people get into drugs a lot earlier. So actually.
Yeah. Well, I had a dabble earlier. I was on and off earlier, you know. There was, back in the day, there was speed and God knows what going around. And I'd had a dabble earlier. And I realised that I had that nature because I liked it, you know.
Yeah.
I liked it. I liked the feeling. I think I tried speed as well, and it was. I felt like, you know, great. I felt like I could see the world, you know, sharply, clearly. I felt really, I don't know, like buzzing.
Well, if you do have ADHD, that's why they give you Ritalin, right?
Yeah.
Because it just matches your.
Yeah.
The speed of your thought process. Yeah. So it probably did feel really good.
It was like putting glasses on.
Yeah.
And then I thought I'd never do, you know, anything else, you know, never do cocaine or anything like that. And, you know, that was a disgusting drug, sticking up your nose. I watched people do it when I was working on the door, but like, no. And I do ecstasy when I go out and dance and stuff. But, and I, I'd take it or leave it, you know, and but that extremity was there. And I remember people doing it, and I remember thinking, that's never going to be me. Mm. And then I think I tried it one night. A friend said to me, well, try this, you know. I remember doing it and feeling like, wow, like it's just, you know, and then feeling terrible, you know, next day, losing that kind of feeling, this kind of like I could see clearly again, and then feeling a bit overwhelmed and nervous and anxious, horrible, horrible feelings, like not that long after, thinking, and I'm thinking, no, this is a waste of time. It's expensive. It's like, I don't rate this at all, you know, back into my training, you know. And it was kind of like an on and off relationship. And I was doing the Reiki, and now I'm all spiritual. Got another little character on the go, you know, doing Reiki and working at a hospice.
Why did you go from doorman, PT, and that's quite a stretch to start looking into Reiki and spiritual stuff?
Yeah. The Reiki come about, it was my mum's friend. I was working on the door, and she said to me, my shoulder was hurting from training. She put her hands on me, and I felt this heat and this tingle go all the way through me. I was like, I'd known my mum's friend all my life. I went, where'd you learn that? She went, oh, I learned to do Reiki. And I think, oh, yeah, Messiah complex, let's go. So, you know, I was like, I've got to learn this. I really want to learn it. And I was fascinated. I could feel this heat going right through me. And I turned up. I did Reiki one weekend, hyper focus, of course, got through it.
Yeah.
You know, loved it. I'm doing Reiki on goldfish, on plants. Do you know what I mean? Like, my old man's going, what's he doing now? What's he doing now? He's doing, you know what I mean?
What happened to the goldfish?
Yeah. You know, I'm going, like, feel the energy, you know? And it's like, you know, like, I'm talking to the plants, you know, I'm like, and I've gone right down the rabbit hole. I'm thinking, this is great. Everything's energy. I did my Reiki 2. Then I did my Reiki Master, and it got a bit serious because you start asking questions about yourself.
Yeah.
And as well as the training, you do have to ask those inner questions about who you are. And it rattled me because
not many people ask questions to themselves, about themselves.
No, and the guy that was training me was going, so who are you? What is it about? And I was going, I didn't like what was coming back. The kid that was hiding behind all these characters was like, oh. So the Reiki kind of got me a little bit like, oh, actually, it was some deeper questions. And I set up a practice in Hornchurch, actually, and I started really getting into it. I worked at a hospice. I ended up working with terminally ill people, and I was really good at it.
How was that?
Yeah,
it's quite a serious move.
Yeah, you know, one minute I'm a doorman, and now I'm working in the hospice. I was at St Francis, and I used to work with friends and family that were terminally ill.
Wow.
And what it did, it gave me a fear. Suddenly, I wasn't scared of like dying anymore. I wasn't scared of like I felt that there's something more to life. There's an energy, and I work with terminally ill people, like, you know, up to the last week.
Was that for pain, Jamie? Or?
Yeah, so, you know, it was for pain, and it's helping, what we say, for transition, getting them ready, you know, making them feel okay with their fate, where they're going, getting them, helping them to transition, basically. And I had some really profound experiences. I mean, I can't explain it, you know, like I people might poo-poo it or laugh at it, and that's fine. I understand, because I look at someone waving their hands and think the same thing. But I had real sort of deep experiences. I knew there was more to life, and working with terminally ill people, you know, it made me a little bit more grateful in my life. Yeah. It gave me a sense of gratitude. So and after a session, sometimes I feel like I was in this state of grace. It was so good to be in the moment.
Yeah.
You know, because you're sitting there, and for me to sit still and not talk to someone for an hour, you know something good's going on.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm waiting and put my hands here, and I'm concentrating. I'm picking up on stuff. And so I kind of like got into that. You know, I got away from the door. I met this girl, was all loved up, got engaged, and it didn't work out. You know, when I had this girl, was like, I thought, oh, you know, I'm going to get married. And, you know, I got a little bit, you know, that kind of like hyper focus. You know, this is the one, you know, when you say it's the one. And it didn't work out. And I was heartbroken. You know, and there's more to the story, but I haven't got enough time to tell you, but I was heartbroken. And I remember this is when I just went off the rails, you know, and the things that are there in the background, those little habits, little bit now and again, sometimes I go a bit too far, then I was using, and I started to use, you know, more and more.
Yeah.
And I, first of all, it gave me a little bit of relief. You know, first of all, I was like, I was giving it the big one. You know, and I'm trying to train and use, and they don't work.
No.
You know, And then at one point, I was so worried about losing my gains, I'd use and have my Met RX shake under the bed. So get the calories in without losing the weight, you know, and it's absolutely, I mean, it's mental. It was an interesting path, to be fair. I mean, I look back with a sense of like, oh, that was mental. What a roller coaster.
Yeah.
But in my pain, in my kind of walking wounded, rather than go and get help, rather than go and speak to someone, I remember I broke down in front of my mum and dad. I hardly, you know, didn't do that much. You know, I didn't cry till I was about 25, you know, yeah. Like, so there was lots of emotion there. And, you know, my family are lovely, but my dad would give me a hug and we're just not a, you know, my mum, you know, she's not affectionate. That's my mum, you know, and I love my mum to bits, but we have a little hug now, you know. But back then, you just didn't talk about that, you know, and it was like, I was heartbroken and I just didn't talk about it. I need to see a counsellor, I need to see a therapist, you know. I didn't have the courage. I thought I could deal with it myself, you know. And rather go to a therapist, I mean, it's funny now, but I was in the gym, you know, it was a reality TV show. There was a number there. I thought, oh, I'll do that, you know, I'll give it the big one. You know, started, you know, I'm still using, but now I'm in the gym, I'm teetotal again. And now I'm sort of getting a bit bigger. You know, I'm tempted with the steroids now. I'm tempted to put more armor on, of course, because I'm, you know, if I've got more muscle, that's more armor. So no one's going to ever hurt me again. Do you know what I mean?
Did you go down the steroid road?
I did later on. So yeah. I went to this reality TV show. It was, you know, it was a dance show. It was like a reality TV show. It was like reality TV, like this zero to hero kind of thing. You know, Popeye, all that stuff was popular at the time. It was a very similar show to that. It was like a male dance troupe. We're supposed to go to Vegas and see the world, and you know, and it was well put together. I got through out of 500 people. I got picked, so I got the last 20, like a selection process, you know. I'm in the last 20, you know, and I'm like, oh, wow, like, I didn't believe I'd get this far. I thought it'd be a laugh, you know. And I turned up not really knowing what I was going into. I was in good shape, you know, had a good sense of humour. And it was all about, really, it was like, oh, I'll show the world. I'm not hurt. Do you know what I mean? And then I kind of like got into this reality TV show. I got into the last 20, and then I got picked for the final seven, you know, final seven in a troop. I was like, wow. And everyone couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. You know, I was like, wow, like, yeah, you know, this is me now. Look at me. And again, meeting the needs, significance, you know, like that certainty, that kind of like connection. You know, I'm doing shows. Everyone loves you. Everyone knows your name. You know, 15 minutes of fame, you say. You know, and it's kind of like it really, really massaged my ego. And again, it was another buzz for me.
It's a big drug. It's a huge drug.
Yeah, it's a buzz. And you're buzzing off people.
Yeah.
And I remember not doing the show and then feeling, who am I without performing, you know? And it's like, I started like getting on this thing where I had to be on stage, I had to be sent like, and it was really becoming a bit of another addiction, you know? And then like, I kind of like started to chill out about it. And then I remember we were going to go to Vegas and do this tour. And then we got a call and it was like, guys, it's the show's not happening. There's no funding. We pulled the plug. And we're like, what? And we're up in Leeds getting ready, you know, tour. It's not happening. And we was like, what? And absolutely fell apart. We were like, all of us left our jobs. They'd filmed us, you know.
Wow.
They filmed us handing a notice.
Wow.
You know, so I had a really good PT job in a gym in Chigwell, you know, yeah. I was, you know, the gym, you know, and I was really like, I had like PT, I had clients and stuff, and they filmed us, you know, like handing a notice.
Wow.
And it was like a proper like, distraught, and we were all in bits. We were all trying. We'd all left our lives behind. You know.
Well, you just basically given a lottery ticket that didn't work.
Yep. Yep. It was like a bad version of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Do you know what I mean? It weren't the golden ticket, and that was it. We tried to make it work. We did everything we could. It was disastrous. We started falling out. Started arguing. You know, and that's when the demons started for me. Yeah. That's when the pain that I didn't deal with in the first place started to happen. I started using more and more. I started using I'd have these moments of teetotal and, you know, training and like, you know, and then I'd be like, no, I'm not touching that shit anymore. I'm not touching that shit. And then I'd start using again and again. I started hanging around my mates doing it and it became a habit. Yeah. And every time I got something I didn't like, a feeling, I'd go to that place and then it numbs it temporarily.
Mm.
And as soon as it goes, you're left like heart beating at your chest and you just feel awful. It's the worst feeling. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. That feeling on the come down is the worst feeling in the world.
Yeah.
You know, and I can't believe you get addicted to it, because if you can wire yourself to the come down, you know, and that's something I actually started to do. And I got my job back in the gym, but I was still using, and you noticed it. And I was like, and that's when I went to meetings. You know, I got myself into the meetings. You took me to the meeting. I got into the meetings, and I got into, you know, I didn't do the 12 steps, but I went to the meetings. And I remember losing complete trust in myself, losing faith in myself. And I think the week you saw me and said, "Are you all right? Come to a meeting." I was like, no, I'm fine. And that week was the worst week.
Was it?
That week, because I think the game was up.
Yeah.
And I went a bit too far. I didn't mean to, but one night I went too far and I was like, I woke up and I weren't breathing. I looked up, I was like, and I swear, I think, I don't know if I died temporary, I don't know, but there was a feeling of, I'm not breathing, I'm dead.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, am I dead? And I was like, I'm upstairs in my room. My mum and dad know nothing about this. Do you know what I mean? Like, we had an extension, I was in the side bit. And I was like, come upstairs and find me dead. And they wouldn't even know. They wouldn't even know, you know? And I was like, I remember the madness of the mind when I'd say to myself, well, I've not done it in weeks. And suddenly I get a flashback, bang, it was yesterday. Mm. It was 2 hours ago. My mind was playing tricks on me. I thought I was going mental. I thought I was losing my mind. It was the scariest thing to feel like you're losing your mind. Mm. You're losing who you are. You don't know who you are anymore. Your brain's completely wired to it, you know, and it's just nothing but pain, but you just keep going back to it because you don't know any, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. You use more and more bigger doses and it don't fill the void, you know.
That point when the mind's so discombobulated is a terrifying moment.
Yeah.
And it's a good moment because if you catch it,
yeah,
and you don't want to be like that,
yeah,
you could do something about it.
Yeah. And that was a turning point for me. That was and that was the week when you said you were right, come right. And that was like, it got worse that week. It was suddenly the light switch switched on, and I suppose it had to get worse before it got better. And I went too far, and I had this sudden, like, what am I doing? And it just snapped me out of something. I don't know what it was. You call it a higher power? I don't know. You know, it's funny because a psychic said to me once, I don't know about psychics, you know, but this one particular psychic, she was pretty good. She was hit and miss, but sometimes she was bang on. And one night she said, you know, you died that night. And I was like, what? And she said, I never told her about any of this, you know, like, and she was like, but you come back because you've got work to do. And I was like, and I thought it was a bit weird. And I was like, I didn't know whether to, but it was a bit weird as she knew it. And I felt like, I mean, I wasn't breathing. I was like, and I suddenly took that inhale and I was like,
probably done you a massive favour.
Like, I don't know what happened, but something happened. Mm. I can't tell you. And that was the turning point. And then I started going to the meetings and I started checking in. I was really honest with my mate. I had a best mate, didn't really know much about what's going on. You know, I knew I was getting up to stuff. I had some really good friends. He was like calling me 24/7. And I told my dad, the shame of my dad didn't know nothing about it. My dad was like, deep breath. He was like, how did that happen? He went, you're so strong. Like, you're in the gym all the time. You're this person, you know, how did it happen? You know? And yeah.
You know what, mate? I've had their moments, because that's the thing though. When you build up an incredible facade to protect yourself, people can't see the smaller version of yourself inside. Yeah.
And he was like, dumbfounded. He was like, and he was upset that he didn't see it.
Mm.
My mum didn't see it. They didn't know. It was such a secret. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Addiction, such that secret. It's the shame, the guilt, and you hide it, and you know, it's just pain. You know, and my dad didn't know nothing about it. He was gutted. He was so gutted, but he was so proud. You know, and it's probably one of the biggest fights I've ever had. I'd fight anyone in the ring. It's a fight you can't explain. It's an internal fight. You get in the ring, and I'd spar with anyone. I'd spar with Tyson. You know what I mean? Like, actually, I'm a bit old now, not now for Tyson. But you know what I mean? Like, I would have done anything to avoid that fight. And it was the start for me. I went to the meetings, you know, we spoke all the time. I set up a little network of people that my mates, Tito, he's really on it. He phoned me 24/7, you know. Mm. I had some really good friends, you know, that helped me get through. My family, once they knew they've really come together. My dad was like, you know, you're right. And it was the love of the family. It pulled me through, you know. It was like that unit. We become a bit closer. We started talking about stuff. I then got in to therapy. I checked in with a woman called Margaret. She was in, bless her soul, she's gone now, but she was in Chigwell. She was a holistic therapist. And I used to see her every week without fail. I saw her for about 2 years, I think. It was the whole thing, like all the pain that I was avoiding, all that little boy, that shy little boy. Yeah. It was, we did inner child work. And I thought, I've always been that scared little boy. I've always been, you know, and it was, she'd say to me about relationships, you know, like about committing, and, you know, I noticed things about, you know, talking to my mum. I was lucky enough to talk to my mum and find out what, you know, like I had a really traumatic birth and it wasn't easy for my mum. We found out loads of stuff. I asked questions and I found out my granddad had a nervous breakdown, you know, and it was on that side of the family. And then my great granddad had a breakdown from the First World War. You started to explore things and realize, you know, like even like epigenetics, that things are passed, or there are things that are passed down the line, you know. And it was like, it started to make sense to me, you know. Not to blame the past, but you've got that power to change it. And it all started coming up. And then, you know, I think Margaret asked me a question. She was like, do you not think a woman can emotionally support you? And I was like, and I laughed at her. What? Like, you know, and she's like, how is that? You know, and I was like,
good question.
It made me start thinking, actually, I've always relied on myself. I talk to my dad if I have to, but I'll keep it to myself. I don't, you know, it's a weakness crying. It's a weakness talking to a woman, you know, like, because you don't want to like, you upset her, you lose that woman because you just give her, you don't want to like burden her with your baggage and stuff. Keep it to yourself. You know, you don't talk to her. And so consequently, I never shared that in relationships, you know.
This is why a lot of boys commit suicide.
Mm.
Because the inability to communicate, because of passed down knowledge that you're not supposed to, to be this heroic guy. I'm sure it's moved a little bit, but was there a turning point where you was like, this is actually good. I'm enjoying working on myself.
Yeah.
I'm growing.
Yeah.
I'm moving away from thinking about the drugs and all that stuff.
Yeah.
When was that?
I think really, I started doing the work with Margaret and then I started to really turn things around. And then I was searching for meaning and purpose. I was like, you know what? I need to find meaning. I need to turn this around. I'd read Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning.
Yeah.
And it blew me away. You know, he developed logotherapy. He discovered if you can find a meaning, you can get through any suffering. I was like, I've got to turn this around.
Mm.
And I listened to Wayne Dyer. I got really spiritual. I got into Taoism, Buddhism. I wanted more answers. I was searching, you know. I went to see Tony Robbins. You know, I got into coaching. I did my NLP. I got into hypnosis, timeline therapy. I was so interested in the mind. I was interested in people. I got really interested in behaviors because I thought, I want to carry on working on myself, but I want to help others, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like helping others, you kind of like you help yourself, you know. Like I find I'm talking to myself most of the time anyway. you know what I mean? Like you're just doing it through your clients. You know, they say, who coaches you? I go, my clients coach me. I am literally perception projection. You're bumping into yourself all the time, you know.
Well, in saying that, it's a way of not to misinterpret that, but it means that really you're becoming, you know, when you do 10,000 hours of stuff, you learn so much more, don't you? So it's interesting because it's not that you're just sitting there learning off them.
No.
You're teaching them, but you're aware enough to learn off the whole situation, see what part of that is within you and knowing that you're repairing it as you're going along, right?
Yeah. You teach what you have to learn.
Yeah.
I believe that completely. Like it reinforces those new beliefs in yourself, you know, and it's a two-way thing. I love coaching. It's you know, and from what happened with Margaret and the healing I got, I then got into, you know, like NLP, other stuff. Mm. Then I got approached in the gym, this time not to be a doorman. It was like, do you want to do some gang work? Do you want to work with some kids in Bermondsey? So then I started working with gangs. I started doing putting all my knowledge together, the boxing, the martial arts, the personal training, blending it with the coaching, blending it with all the holistic stuff that I learned on my own journey. And I started doing my first bit of gang work in Bermondsey.
And how was that? Because that's quite scary now at first. Because
You know, it was amazing. It was involving London, not there anymore, in East Ham. And it was like we worked with white marginalised youth at the time. It was like BNP and it was all that stuff. And it was getting through to those kids, getting them off the street, doing outreach. And it was the first time I felt like proper meaning and purpose.
Mm.
You know, I felt like, wow, I'm good at this and I love it. You know, I'm really good, you know, and I was like, the more I did it, the better I got. And I could just, yeah. I just could connect with these kids because I know what you're talking about. And allowing myself to be vulnerable. And even the guy I used to work with, you say, do you know what works for you? He's a big guy. And then you get him boxing and that. And then you go like, when's the last time you talk, say something really vulnerable? Well, you show them vulnerability.
Yeah.
And then they show you vulnerability. Yeah.
Some of these kids that are really violent just want a hug. They just want to be seen, heard, loved or hugged or something. Yeah. And the opposite is the violence and the rage because they can't express it.
No.
So for you to do that, it's a big gift to allow that.
Yeah. And from then on, it just got better and better. You know, I got asked to do Jamie Oliver's. So I worked at Jamie Oliver's for 9.5 years running their programs.
Wow, really?
So I was like a resident life coach. I used to run all their wellbeing programs. You know, I used to go in and, you know, coach the 15 Foundation, all the kids. You know, some of them are really big stars and they're doing really well.
That's amazing.
And it was a real privilege to be involved with that.
Yeah.
And then I just started to grow. You know, I started doing work in Havering, in my local area where I used to live, working with youth offenders, young offenders. You know, NEETs, not in employment, education and training. Then I started teaching. In the end, I worked in a Prue school, pupil referral unit in Isle of Dogs.
Right.
And I got qualified as a teacher. Well, the first part of teaching, yeah. And I ended up specialising in teaching personal training qualifications. And it was really good because I could take them from Key Stage 4 all the way through to Key Stage 5 and 6, you know, like train them up as personal trainers and watch them grow.
Wow.
From that kid on the street, you know, that's getting in and out of trouble, that's not looking good for their future, and take them up. So again, expanding, finding meaning and purpose, you know, and now it's kind of like I've still got clients, I still do personal training, I still do my coaching clients, I have like private clients as well.
Yeah.
But the schools I've kind of developed, everything I've learned, it's kind of a holistic approach. You know, and it's looking at what works, how to engage those kids. How does it work? What, you know, how do I get through to them? What can I do? You know, and it seems to work. I seem to have a formula that works. So, but it's from the journey.
This is the thing though. This is what I love. I love this because it's a transferable skill from the adversity to helping other people. And I think that's powerful about this journey. That's why I called this is powerful because through my stuff, my pain, my experience, I have the ability to talk to someone from a knowledgeable place, not something that I've read and that's an opinion.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that, but I do feel like with yourself, I've seen you train and I've seen how you are. And, you know, even the nuances you use and the language you use when I trained with you, other people don't have it. If someone's suffering out there with addiction and stuff like that, or sort of problems and don't know how to talk about it, what would you recommend they do?
So I would recommend the first thing is allowing themselves to feel vulnerable, to allow, you know, to be okay with being vulnerable, you know. And it's like I always say, talk to someone, find someone you can trust, go and speak to someone. That's the first part of it, is admitting that you are in pain, you're in trouble, you know, like you find that courage to talk to someone. That's the first part of it, you know. And I would say to any man out there, any boy out there, you know, particularly men and boys, girls as well, but the men and the boys, like, find that kind of strength in showing your emotions. Find that strength in allowing yourself to cry. Just let it out. You know, like it's not as bad as you think. You know, it can be frightening. Yeah. It can be so frightening to let out those emotions. You think you're never going to stop. You think it's all going to come out, it's going to get out of control, and you're trying to put a lid on it. But my advice is, you know, go to that place, find someone you can trust, get help, you know, and trust that vulnerability, trust the sensitivity. Like, it's part of who you are, you know. You ain't a robot, you're a human being, you know, and you're here to learn, to experience, you know, and part of it is living that full spectrum of all them emotions, you know. It's like the shadow, you know, like face up to that fear. We've all got a shadow. You know, me and you are constantly doing the work. We think we've got it, and suddenly we just like get caught unawares, and we're like, "Oh, I'll lose the temper." Oh God, you know, go back in and look on the inside. But it's having that courage to talk to someone and just put your hand up and say, "I need help." You know, that's how it starts, and it's the start of a journey, and you won't regret it. And if you're feeling down, depressed, like that, like you can't, like you're having suicidal thoughts, or you're thinking that, you know. I was in the same way, I was in the same place. Don't ever get sad with, you know, like in a year's time, it could all change, you know.
Yeah, everything passes, everything changes.
Changes. In a year's time, it could all change. Your life could just literally change. But it starts with holding your hand up and saying, I need help. That's it for me, yeah.
Thank you, James Skipper.
This Is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scholford and at @this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up and you can get in touch with us because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Eber Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Ria Musa and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me. Hi, everybody. I'd really love to hear your views so that we can produce a podcast with the content that matters to you. It doesn't matter if you just joined us or if you've been listening from the start. We would love you to fill in the short listener feedback form, which you can find in the show notes. And let me know your thoughts on our podcast. It would really mean a lot. Thanks, guys.